hand over tonight to my good friend Claude, who's come out. Where have you come from? All the way from Los Angeles. No pressure.
Thanks, Charlie.
Hi, everybody. My name's Claude. I'm an addict.
Hi, Claude.
I'm not American. Well, I am. Technically, actually, I am American. Anyway, so I can't thump any books. I'll try to thump some books. I desperately want to thump some books. You know, if I could thump some books, I'd... No one told me to swear, but no, I couldn't swear, by the way. You didn't tell me I couldn't swear. You told that dude he couldn't swear. But I can swear, right?
Yeah.
No. Okay, thank you. I'm glad we sorted that out. Listen, it's a real honour. It's a real honour to be asked to speak at any NA meeting. I'm a really grateful recovering addict. I come from here. I was just getting off the tube just now. I was standing outside here when I was a 13-year-old kid. I found myself and my identity, and I found my people in the fucking club. Oopsie, sorry. In the clubs at Heaven, at Taboo, at the Bat Cave, you know, at the Mud Club. And I found speed, and I had a Pam Hog skirt on, and I'm sure I looked completely ridiculous. But I found myself, you know, and I found my peace. And it's just funny just now, my good friend came with me, and thank you so much. I really, you know, even 10 years ago, I wouldn't have said I needed support for anything. You know, it was a big, you know, the last speaker was talking about crying. I don't cry, you know, I'm not a big crier. You know, it took me years to cry in recovery. I mean, years, you know. And I still find it very difficult, but I felt really emotional walking. You know, every time I walk down from Notting Hill down to where the Central Line starts, I get that feeling that comes over me when I was a kid and I'd be walking down those stairs and I would feel like my cares and my sort of everything that was bottled inside of me kind of lifting off of me, and I would go into that sort of dark, dense nightlife and I would lose myself and I'd feel free, you know, and I'd be off my tits on speed. That was my first good time, and there was no there was nothing there. There wasn't the things that sort of bogged me down in my regular life. So that was a good feeling just now. I just want to say for the record, I'm kind of exhausted. I'm here. I moved to Los Angeles 13 years ago. I often say I moved to Los Angeles 10 years ago because I want it to feel like less, because I'm sort of ashamed that I moved to Los Angeles. And I went there for a year for a work situation, and I've ended up being there 13. And in that time, I mean, I'll backtrack, but in that time that I left my home fellowship, I left here with 6 or 7 years. I have 19 years clean next month. So, thank you. Well, it's not, you know, and the only reason I will have that is because will do whatever I have to do to stay clean, you know. And if that means I have to stand up here and look like a tit for 40 minutes, then I'll sit here and be a tit. And I have to give myself permission to look like a tit. If I have to look like a tit, I'm going to look like a tit. And that's just the way it's going to be, and I'll survive. What was I saying? Oh, in that 13 years, so what's happened? I don't know why I'm starting this way, but this is where we're going with it, so this is how we're going with it. Since I moved from here, everything collapsed when I got there. I had like 7 years clean, everything collapsed. A year or two later, my mother came to visit me out there, and she was a terrible addict, like really big, sort of, you know, successful using addict, you know, just out there, just real drama, just bang, you know, it's a fucking, I can't, sorry, Gary, please forgive me, you can talk to somebody about it later, but I'm praying right now that I don't do it again, but I, you know, I'm so drove my mother to rehab 12 years ago, you know, when I got, so the power of me not being in my London fellowship, if I can be of some service, and if I can tell you the message that was carried by me leaving here, was my mother got clean a year after I left here. I got married, which is bizarre and fantastic all at the same time, because it wasn't on my radar as something I ever really wanted to do with my life. I had a big ambition that I would have lots of children with lots of different people. That was really the plan for many years. I thought that was a cool plan. But anyway, I got married to the guy who kind of 13-stepped. Well, that's another story which I'll go back into in a sec. I got married to him and I had a couple of children. So I've been, look, long story short, the last few years I've been taking my children to visit. I discovered, you know, through my step work and through my service in here, I discovered that I'm a very dutiful person. You know, I mean, my husband could give two shits about duty. It's just not who I am. I discovered that it's really important that I show up for these people that have, whether they've been there for me or whether they haven't been there for me, it hasn't really affected the way that I treat it. A few years ago, I took my then 3-year-old son, I took him to Paris to see my granny, my father's mother, who abandoned him just after the war. He ended up in a Czech orphanage. You know, these were all like first-generation English people after the war. Excuse me. And she had nothing to do with me my whole life. But I just, through the process of doing this and through my amends process, I took my son there, and I've got a picture. She died a few months afterwards. I've got a picture of me, my son, and this woman, and we look alike. You can see the lineage, you know, between us all. And it was such, it was so profound for me. And it became really profound that despite the fact that I'd had nothing to do with her, you know, she really never had, you know, whatever in my life. But I wanted to, regardless of whose side of the street was clean or wasn't clean, I wanted to show up because that it's just become important to me. And last year, the following year after that, I brought, I've got an old Russian aunt, she's my great-great aunt, she lives in Jerusalem. I brought her over here, we rented a house, like, so we could all be together, and I could just be around her. I can't ask her to travel, you know, 14 hours to Los Angeles, so I did that. It was awful, she got very sick, but she got to meet my family. But since then, I've gone there every year, you know, with my kids, to show my kids. I had another child, 3.5 years ago. So I've just come back. This is a really roundabout way of saying I'm really tired because I've been on my own with two kids the past two kids. And I work a lot. One of my things was, okay, I'm going to stop working. You know, we're going to go on this journey. You're going to meet some of the people that you come from. So you have a sense of your history because I don't feel my history when I'm out there. So we've just been on this trip to Jerusalem. I took my dad also. My dad likes a drink. That was difficult. And I, you know, was herding cats, basically, for this entire time that I was there. And I discovered, it was quite amazing, because the thing that I've gone out there to be of service and to show, you know, my duty, my love for this woman, that sounded weird, no, my, you know, whatever, my respect and my love for this woman who was always there for me. This woman, like, showed up like no one else. And my ego, I discovered a new way that my ego has taken over, which is I don't need any fucking thing from you or anything else. My dad just sat there, everything was, like, delivered, you know, this is your room, you sit, you know, your meal times at this, you know, and I found out, wow, you know, you've turned being of service into a new egomania. Like, congratulations, you know, you found a new way to show how fantastic you are, you know, because I wanted his approval, you know. And I realized that I heard this saying recently, that I can worship at the altar of other people's approval. Like, it's become a new thing for me. You know, the last speaker was talking about not giving a shit what other people think about him. I can give the impression that I don't give a shit of what you think about me, but it isn't true, because I really do care, and I really want you to tell me how fantastic I am a lot of the time, but covertly, like, you know, and I want it from you covertly, and I'll manipulate you to get it. Oh, fuck, I found a new thing. This is why the work never ends, you know. But anyway, I'm tired. I'm so grateful that I have the means and the opportunity to do this, and I have the presence that I can go and do these things with my life, and the freedom to make those kinds of choices. Because I would used to go there and see her to detox, basically. I'd go there because I spent most of my drug career coming off drugs. I mean, that's really what being a drug addict meant to me was I was always coming off drugs. Like every 2 weeks, I'm going to go and get off, you know, go. And it wasn't, you know, that's just what it was for me. I wasn't a very successful drug addict. I was a shit drug addict is the bottom line of what happened. And what time did I start speaking? No, I'm just joking. So this is what happened. I came to this country. I was born in 1970, right at the height of the hippies and the, you know, the freaks. I was actually born in Los Angeles because my dad was, he was working out there, and he was friends with all those sort of musicians and freaks, and they all took acid and they were all kind of out of it and beautiful, like just these gorgeous people. They were really just fantastic to look at and completely out of their minds, just gone. And we moved about, you know, went all over the place in this very dramatic, fantastically dramatic way. We ended up in Brazil for a couple of years. My dad got into black magic. My mum got into hepatitis. You know, it was like really cool moves. And, you know, I was a little Brazilian, you know, beach kid for a couple of years. It came here when I was six, you know, sort of a little brown, bare-chested, sort of, you know, just completely like, what the hell? You know, I've come here and everyone's, you know, with respect to anyone who is of blonde hair, you know, everyone, you know, it just sort of felt like I went to school and I was amongst... And then to add to the confusion, you know, my dad found Judaism, which was, you know, kind of our heritage. But no one had ever really practiced that. So I came to this country in 76, really, or in my memory. Went to school, had a baby brother. Look, this is boring. I don't know why I'm telling you this. So we went from there, and a few years later, the long and the short of it is, at that point, how my addiction worked was I started off in the ego and in fantasy and sort of making up stories, and that's where it started. And I was really... an upfront cocky kid, because I didn't. I thought I kind of had to. I had to be an upfront cocky kid. I went from there. You couldn't tell me shit as well when I was a kid. You just really couldn't tell me a damn thing. From there, I got into this very good girls' school miraculously, and I don't know why I'm saying this even. But anyway, I got into this school. Thought I was the shit, and actually, what it was is I had I been able to articulate what I was experiencing at that point, was I felt deeply that I couldn't belong, and I couldn't sort of relate with other people, and that I had to be more sort of fronty or more streety or more clever or more blah, 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 blah. You know, and all these girls came from these sort of nice... Well, not all of them. And I'm sure everybody has problems and stuff going on for themselves, but they came from these what seemed to me like sort of nice, stable homes, and they went to Devon and... you know, ate ice cream and, you know, people cooked. And it just sort of seemed very nice and normal to me. And my home life was sort of very chaotic. It was, my parents split up in 80... Well, they had already been split up. My mother had boyfriends, my dad had sort of girlfriends. And it was quite violent in my home. And I was very protective of that. I was desperate that people not know sort of what went on in my home and how I, it's so funny because I was yesterday, please forgive me if I jump around a lot, it's just where I'm at, it's just how it's going today, but I was at the zoo yesterday with my kids and my son jumped and he smacked his head on this thing, there's blood everywhere, like a big drama, all these people coming, there's blood, there's this, and I've gone into, you know, you just sort of go into mode, and you sit and you look and you tell them to breathe. And last night, I felt so emotional, and I realised that when I was a kid and stuff would go on, you know, one time my mum's nose got really violently broken, and I've walked in, and I remember thinking it, like, and that was one of my fantasies, that I would be powerful. You know what I mean? And I would be strong and I could stop shit from going on. And I remember sitting down again, you're going to, it's okay, and this, and we're going to breathe and just do the thing. And I felt like I was a very old child, you know, when I was that kind of thing. And I sort of protected that whole situation. And plus, I adore my dad. You know, I totally adored this person. So when they split up, there was a real relief and a real sadness, you know. And I went, my dad went off with my brother and he became a big Jew, and my mother and I went off to this weird sort of abandoned building in Ladbroke Grove that her dad owned. Jesus. And started again. And my mother was in the throes of her addiction, and she had this brilliant boyfriend called Dean, who was a dread. He used to take me to all the Shebeens in Ladbroke Grove with my friend Deborah. Mm-hmm. And so we'd go to all the Shebeens, so we really thought we were street. You know, we really thought... So we went to this very nice... we went to this sort of nice girls' school by day, and we wore sort of nice pink gingham dresses, and we were in the Shebeens at night, kind of rolling spliffs and sort of thinking we were Rasta. Do you know what I mean? And which is kind of bizarre, if you're looking at me right now, to think that I am... I actually told people I was a quarter Jamaican when I first got clean, because I thought that I kind of was, you know, like I kind of deserved it by that point, because I spent so much time, you know, in Shebeens. I thought that was cool. So that's kind of where it started, you know, and it started my sort of the love of being in a dark place and sort of feeling older than I was and feeling powerful and feeling like I was empowered and a grown-up, and I could handle anything that was sort of thrown at me. And my addiction was really fun for a while, I will say. I really believe that drugs were a great friend to me for many years. I really think they got me through some times that I couldn't have really faced without them, and they helped me to sleep at night. You know, they helped me to survive, you know, what I found emotionally tough. I didn't really know, I wouldn't have known how else to deal with it. So I'm very grateful at that point that I found something to sort of take the edge off, you know, what was going on in my life. And even if that hadn't been going on in my life, my head is such a fantastic, it's so fantastically caustic so much of the time that I needed protection from that, you know. So, long stories. I get through school, I meet a guy when I'm sort of 16, 17, and he's using Git, right? So he was a lot older than I was. And you know, so I start using on the weekends with this guy. I didn't know it at the time, my mother's boyfriend at the time was also using Git. So we start having this weird thing where we're sort of coming off gear every couple of weeks, you know, and he's giving me his biceps. You know, so it was very weird. And I was sort of using drugs with them, and it was all sort of very, very enmeshed and weird. At 17, I basically stole and got kicked out of the house by my mother. It got very, very messy. And I ended up here in the West End, trawling these streets here, weeping my fucking eyes out, not knowing what to do. Because I'd crossed a line with myself. I'd gone from what was social, recreational using and fun, and I'd crossed a line into addiction that was... I had a habit by that point. I was stealing at that point. I was still at school at that point, which is even more bizarre. And I had no home. And I'd completely fallen out with my mother, who was completely enmeshed with. And there began sort of five extremely dark years for me, of going from squats and then finding somewhere to live and finding, you know, everything being great for a while and then everything being shit, and sort of being with this guy, and he was fantastic because he drove a BMW, do you know what I mean? That was pretty much as far, good as it got for me. And that's where I was at, you know, and it was kind of horrendous, you know. And I... Siri needs to shut the fuck up right now. You know, at the end of my using... And I never anticipated that I could get clean. I never had any... I never knew that this existed, you know. And if it did exist, I thought you were all weird and born-again Christians. And I didn't know that recovery could work for someone like me. I thought that I was too tangled and it wasn't going to work for someone like me. And what ended up happening was one of my dealers actually took me. There was a meeting in Ladbroke Grove that I will keep anonymity going, but he was very impressed because there was a very famous singer who played the piano and is very famous and wears big glasses, and that's all I'm going to say. Anyway, he made the tea at this meeting, and my dealer was like, Gary makes a tea at this meeting. So anyway, he takes me to this meeting, and I'm off my nut, and I'm all I can think is all these people complaining, you know, and I'm in the back, and it's just awful and hot, and I think this is shit. But I take some literature with me, and what happened that night was, I remember specifically there were 21 meetings a week when I took that, and it was 1991, and I still have it somewhere, the Where to Find from my first NA meeting in 1991. And what I did was, I had we had a little white booklet, and we were doing a lot of coke, and I thought if I read the 12 steps 12 times, it would stop me wanting to use in the morning. So I read it 12 times, like I read, you know, the 12 steps through 12 times. I used the other thing up to make some bags, because, you know, that was a good size for it. It was just a pamphlet, it wasn't, you know, anything too big. And I thought that I would incant like a magic spell that would lift from me the desire to stop using. And as I said previously, you know, my using really wasn't about using. It was always about stopping. I was always stopping. I was always going away somewhere to get clean. You know, every other weekend I was going away to, you know, my mum had this little place by the sea. I'd go there to get clean, or I'd go somewhere else to get clean, or I was kipping on someone's couch because I needed to get clean. Or, you know, I was constantly on these endless detoxes. It was like a nightmare. The last couple of years of my using, every time I used, I wept. On my way to my dealers, I would hustle up the money, you know, enough money to get it together, and I would cry on the way to my dealers because I didn't want to do it anymore, and I didn't have any other solution. I didn't know how to stop. I didn't know how to stop. I didn't know how to stay stopped. You know, I didn't know how to meet the overwhelming desire to be off my nut. I didn't know how to meet that. I didn't know how to meet fire with fire. I didn't have the power. The very definition of powerless. And I thought I was lost. I really thought, and I remember one of my mum's friends saying to me, once a junkie, always a junkie, and I believed it. I've got it written still, once a junkie, always a junkie. You know, and I thought that was it. I'd cross this line I would never be able to sort of return from. So what happened was, my last year or so, my mum had this company. I thought, what I need is structure. I'm going to get a job, because jobs really, you know, get people clean. And I went and, you know, and I'd sort of disappear. And one time, basically, I'd go and disappear for a bag. And one time I disappeared for 3 days, and that's kind of the long shot. And I remember going back into the building, and no one had seen me for 3 days because I'd been on this crazy bender where I'd ended up with these guys who'd done this robbery, and it was just sort of terrible, you know, sort of, and it was like the Twilight Zone. And I walked in, and a friend happened to call, and as she called, I said, I can't do it anymore, I'm done, I can't do it, you've got to help me. I mean, I have to be coming down from crack at the time, which helps, you know, when you're on the come down, you feel really terrible and alone and desperate. So that was my friend at that point. And that day I called and I got myself into a place. And I was in a place within 10 days. I was in a treatment centre. I went to a treatment centre. I did not believe that that place was going to get me or keep me clean. So I sort of did that. And I, this is in 1993. I followed the rules there. I ended up going from there to a halfway house in Bournemouth. I went from there. I got a room at the YWCA, and I had this little room, and it was my one safe place, you know. And this is where my life began from this little room at the YWCA in Boscombe in Bournemouth. And everyone else in there was, you know, using, and there were girls, you know, on the game, and it was all, you know, but I felt really at home there. And it was the first time that I had a safe place for myself, you know, and that I stopped trying to kill myself, in short. And I understood what it was that we did here, but I couldn't do what it was that we did here. You know, I'd often go to meetings and I'd be the only girl in the room. And this is nothing to say with our fellowship, or, you know, what's wrong or what's right with our fellowship. When I first got clean, our meetings were not as abundant as they are now. They weren't as cosmopolitan as they are now. They weren't as mixed as they are now. It was just a very different place to recover in the early 90s. And I eventually ended up coming back to London for a work. I was offered a... I was offered a session on this thing. I'd always been a musician. This is how I sort of left this part of the story. I'd been, I'd been able to sort of make eke at some points. I'd been able to do bits of session work. I forgot this one bit of the story. I'd actually started coming to meetings in 91, and I'd sort of ended up dating the guy who was taking the meeting, who I happen to be married to today, I will also add. But I will tell you the moral of that story was that he relapsed after 2 years because I couldn't stay clean. Well, it's not the moral of that story. He's still clean. Whatever. You know, that's his thing. He'll come one day, he can tell you the story. This is my story, and I'm just going to... So, that was one of my ways of getting clean, was changing my playmates. You know, I thought if I change... Anyway, whatever. That's totally irrelevant at this point. I basically spent a year and a half in the fellowship in London trying to sort of make it look like I fit in here, you know, and trying to sound like sort of what I heard other people talking like. I would try and sort of emulate what they would sound like. And in the early 90s, in a lot of the London meetings, it was kind of a dramatic place to recover. Like, there was chairs getting thrown. There was like meetings would fold in a day. There was people getting fucked up. People would come to meetings and steal the pot. Like, there was all this stuff went on. And it was like... I mean, I'm sure it all goes on now, right? I mean, of course, why not? But at the time, it felt sort of exciting. But look, I had my seat here, and I'd paid for my seat with my pain and my soul being crushed, and you know, my sweat. And if you're new, I just want to tell you, you paid for your seat. You've paid for your seat more than you ever need. Keep it. You know, you don't need to lose it. I did not actively work a program my first year and a half. And it wasn't that I didn't know about working a program. I just didn't think that it was complicated enough for me. I didn't think that it would do for me what it would do for you. And I didn't have the maturity required as someone who was getting clean to actively to put myself on top of this and to make it work for my life and embrace it because my life depended on it. I just didn't have the maturity. You know, so I did what we did around here. I went to the dances, I hung out, I had friends, I spoke this, you know, I did the right things, I made the right moves. But the bottom line was, I heard someone say in a meeting last night, I can do anything and stay clean. I can't do anything and stay clean. There are certain things I cannot do that will not help me stay clean. And I found that out. I found out what powerlessness looks like to me because I found myself with my back to the wall spiritually and I picked up because I had no choice. You know, and that's what I found out about how addiction works in my life today. You know, I can be doing what I'm doing here, but I have to be working some kind of program because what happens is the walls start closing in on me and before I know what I'm doing, I'm acting out in all kinds of ways because I need to feel better. You know, it's not normal to always live in pain. And I think me as a recovering addict, if I'm always in pain, I will do something to medicate myself. So I found out the hard, you know, for me, what I, you know, and what happened, and I was exceptionally lucky. There were people in this fellowship that, in fact, I will tell you, it was a guy who I'd really judged. This guy was always hitting on newcomers, and he's, you know, I just like, ugh, he'd speak. I'd be like, ugh, can't stand that, you know, just couldn't stand him. And he showed up, and he took me to a meeting. And another friend of mine showed up, and they took me to meetings until I wanted to take myself to meetings. You know, because every day I wanted to use after that. And I wanted to use because I ended up drinking, basically. And I ended up, this is even sadder, I ended up drinking half a bottle of NyQuil after I'd drunk because I wanted to get knocked out. I thought, fuck it, if I've relapsed, you know, my preferred state is knocked out. I really don't like being a bit buzzed. I prefer being knocked out. You know, it's a nice place to be for me. I like it. Works well. And that's kind of how I spent, you know, the majority of my using was trying to sort of get to that point between, you know, death. Just a few steps forward of death was a good spot. I owe my life to these people. I, without a doubt, owe my life to these people who walked me to 30 meetings in 30 days. I was so embarrassed about, you know, about what happened and that I started hitting meetings of the other fellowship because I didn't have a strong I didn't have a strong step one around alcohol. I came from alcoholics. And I tell you, this woman said the thing that I still do to this day is this old AA lady came up to me and said, pray tomorrow morning for you to stay clean, and at night say thank you because it's polite. And that the next morning I prayed to stay clean that day, and in the night time I said thank you because it was polite, and I stayed clean that day, and I did it again the next day, and I did it again the day after that. I got a sponsor, a new sponsor who was who seemed like someone who was comfortable in her skin. Like, she looked people in the eye when she spoke. She was very self-assured. She didn't take any crap from anybody, and she was able to sit in a meeting without any of the other, you know, stuff that goes on, and she held her space. And I was so impressed by this woman. I'd seen her around for years, and I approached her and asked her to sponsor me, and this woman started my journey of healing and my spiritual journey. And as I said previously, I got very, you know, my first 5 years after that, I got very involved with service. I got very involved with the helpline. I sponsored a lot of girls. I took meetings. And not automatically. I was extremely angry the first 2 years. I had to deal, you know, I had to walk through a lot of my stuff. I had to find out what addiction looked like on a character defect level and what that meant to me with how I viewed the world. And when I got to 5 years clean, which actually sounds like a lot now that I talk about, but I got to meet myself. I got to see myself for the person that I was becoming, and the person that 2 years later moved out from England and went to live a new life in a new country, you know, which at the time I didn't want to do, and I don't even know if I still... That is something I really want. And I went there because I had a work opportunity, and as I said... that work opportunity completely collapsed, and then another door opened for me. And so I went down that road, and I started going to NA meetings in Los Angeles, and I started to, despite the fact that I've never used there, despite the fact that everything about me is very different to my peer group there, a lot of people go to another fellowship there. I sort of had to draw my line in the sand and stay in NA there. I take a meeting there. I sponsor girls there. And my life opened up again. I will say, after the birth of my first child, my meeting attendance really started to wane. And like for 3 or 4 years, I was probably doing, you know, less meetings than is probably healthy for me. And that's just what needed to happen for a while. And I basically ended up picking up cigarettes, which is, you know, is. It's neither here nor there, except that 2 years ago I ended up in like parking lot smoking behind my car and then stubbing it out and going home and showering and changing my clothes and then doing it all again, like hiding from the lady who helps me with my kids. You know, I mean, just like mad shit, you know, around cigarettes. And discovering that, the behaviour's still there. Like, I'm still really sneaky. I steal cigarettes. I mean, it was just madness. Like, somebody would walk into a meeting and I'd grab them, I'd take them outside, you know, really interested in them, you know, because I want a cigarette. You know, it was madness. So it was interesting to see that after that amount of time clean, that person was still alive and well. That was great. So anyway, I basically, the long and the short of it was, is it brought me back on a different level to the steps and to work with my sponsor and to have a new awakening around, you know, what I need to do to stay here another 20 years, which is what I want. You know, I will tell you that the last few years I've had some like trippy, fantastically amazing things go on, like in my work life and in my personal life, and like things that dreams are made of have gone on, and things that, you know, should really only happen to other people, and it still freaks me out to this day, some of the stuff that I'm able to do, some of the freedoms that I have and the choices that I have. But yesterday when I was with my kids and I'm just reading a bedtime story to them, and my kid was okay, didn't need stitches. You know, it's so stupid, but I was so suddenly aware of the vulnerability of us and the vulnerability of these children. And actually, it's enormous that I'm taking my kids around the world on my own, and I'm able to introduce them to all these things, and I'm able to show them this life. The beauty was in the simplicity that I could read my kid a story last night, you know, and that was it. I'm reading my kid a story and we're going to sleep. This morning I got up, I handed my day over to the God of my understanding, who I've recently come to rely on again for probably the however many times I've had to redefine my higher power since I've been here. And it was gorgeous, and here I am. If you're new, I want to welcome you with all of me, and if I haven't said something that will keep you here, please find someone that will. We need you as much as it's a symbiotic relationship. You know, we need newcomers here. We need you to stay. We need you to keep us clean, and you need us. That's the dance. You know. So thank you, Gary. Thank you, Charlie. And that's it. I'm done. Cheers.